Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is the third part of episode 36, where we are discussing Peter Fleming's The Human Capital Hoax, Work, Debt, and Insecurity in the Era of Uberization, published in the Journal of Organization Studies in 2017. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. In this part of the podcast, we want to look at the broader themes of the article and synthesize some of the ideas and how they relate to research and things that we've been seeing in the work that we do. One of the things that occurs to me when I was reading the criticism Fleming is describing about the nature of employee relations and the support changing is that, yes, those changes are occurring, but I think there's also an aspect, there's increased job mobility now where you would get in a firm and you would stay in this firm for 30 or 40 years, and still that still sometimes happens. But in many regards, it is actually valued in our economy that you essentially go to the employer for skills and development and progression, but not necessarily lifetime employment. And I wonder if there's a little bit of nostalgia in some of the points he brings up about, well, that we have this more paternalistic, more involved management. And I'm not criticizing, I'm just saying, but Tom had talked earlier about these larger driving forces in the economy and developing nations and lower wages and those kinds of things. And so I do wonder if sometimes it's a bit of a lament for to go back to the old ways of doing business. But I do believe Fleming makes a call for rethinking this view of human capital theory and realizing that these other consequences of the theory put into practice do impact people in many negative ways. And I think that's a good call that he makes.
I think definitely the question that he asks, is human capital a public or private good? It's going to be a difficult one to answer. So then what is the real balance and what impact does this have on things such as education? Because embedded in our discussion has been what really is the purpose for pick your level of education? What is the purpose for primary education? What's the purpose for secondary education, tertiary, et cetera? That's got to be relooked in some fashion because just about all of the forces, and it also comes out in the Mumby paper, all just basically say that each level of education is losing its way, not just because of the forces that are in with Fleming, but also, or that Fleming brings out, but also because of just political pressures, demands on the system to either show performance or provide certain skills or what have you that are current without necessarily addressing the philosophical question. We've seen a lot of movement towards blended education or distance education programs. Well, that's not quite working out the way we want. And it's similar with the for-profit colleges. So then, are we going to continue to experiment with all sorts of wild ideas, or are we going to finally step back and say, what's the purpose for primary, secondary, tertiary, beyond lifelong learning? Some of these things that we've constantly discussed about, but now we've got to come to a conclusion as to, is this a government function? Is this a private function? Is it an individual responsibility? What's the mix or synthesis of those three? I don't know if we never solve those philosophical questions or never address them adequately, I don't know that we'll ever this problem.
So widening the issue, I think that the question, is education public or private, has an underlying assumption. And that's why the question is posed in the first place, which is by going to college, by pursuing tertiary education, you're going to be placed in a much higher level in society. So inequality, I think, is the issue that generates this question. Because if you assume that if you have a society that's more equal, in which either if you're a doctor or if you're a taxi driver, you're more or less are sure that you can, you have enough welfare and I would say public policies that is going to help you to have a decent life, and the gap in wages is not so big In a way, you can say that people pursue education because they really are, you know, they have a calling for that. And then different people end up doing different things, you know. So there's no problem for thinking that in a public terms because, in a way, everyone has access and they do that because, you know, it's a way that's going to find a role that's going to contribute for society. But since tertiary education has been traditionally associated with a bigger gain, you know, there is this idea, the problem arises now. Should
yes.
the public pay for you to pursue further education and then you're going to reap the benefits?
Oftentimes, even tertiary education is generally referred to as this good for society. But Pedro, you hit the nail on the head. In many cases, it's largely an individual benefit that is developed or is an outgrowth of that. And I'm not saying that there's no public interest in having a more highly educated workforce or populace or those kinds of things. So, but maybe the issue is, okay, you get some subsidy or some kind of loan, but it's not a free pass or unlimited funds for pursuing education as far as you want, because, you know, education is a limited resource. So it's not as if, I mean, even in countries where the education, you don't pay for secondary education, or the government pays for it. What they'll do to their way of rationing it or apportioning it or deciding who gets it is it's based on test scores. So in Germany, for example, they have this thing they call the Abitur, which is your, I guess, the rough equivalent of the Scholastic Aptitude Test in the United States, where it's this pre-college exam that you take. And in Germany, there are certain majors you can't take unless your test score is high enough. So lots of pressure on people to get a particular result or score high enough on these tests. I'm not criticizing. It's just that's one way that society balances. In the United States, it's usually done with money, but it's also they also have test scores as well.
Yeah. In the end, though, the end game ought to be: do we have, for example, the requisite number of doctors in the requisite number of places in order to provide the requisite service? But then it also gets to the professional autonomy, which is a little bit different than, say, the responsible autonomy of the workers that is discussed in Fleming. When we're talking about doctors, there's a whole sort of corporateness and sustainment of the domain of expert knowledge of medicine that doctors take on as a responsibility, which is overlooked, I think, in when you apply human capital theory concepts to the professions. So we can't, or maybe better to say that we shouldn't look at doctors in the human capital sense because of the specialized nature of their work. And so then the question becomes, how do we get back professionalism, wrestle it away from this human capital model? How will we get back professionalism so that we can manage or essentially improve the access and ability for the medical community to serve the public?
You see, and I tend to agree with you on this, that there are some professions where that strict cost benefit of public-private investment and skills development is not just an individual thing. There's a larger societal interest in many of the professions, whether it's engineering or doctors or education. I think you can make an argument, because that sounds like what you were doing, that those professions have many more factors involved that really don't lend themselves to a strictly fee-for-service, build a skill, plug in here kind of mindset to developing the talent. Is that where you were going with that?
Yeah, and I would even extend that to the trades. I think there's a similar case to be made with the trades, which we're talking about electricians, plumbers, those who provide very, very important aspects of society. They don't fit the traditional aspects of professionalism, but they're also influenced by this human capital concept that is causing a lot of stress on them, causing them to be overworked or what have you. And there's an expectation that, within society that we have the ability to tap into those types of resources in order for us to be able to sustain our ordinary lives. They provide very, very valuable functions. So I think there's a philosophical question that probably could go all the way down to all forms of vocation as to what is that balance between, the mm-hmm. individual's yeah. needs, wants, desires, and what society's need, want, desire, because that by vocation, by trade, what have you, you would see probably a different balance as far as how you answer the question. Is it a public good or the human capital being public or private? And so then you think about how that may mean or what that may translate to economically for the educational system through policies and procedures, et cetera.
So if I'm listening correctly, we are now turning the whole issue on its head. Fleming was looking at the hidden costs and the problems of this idea of human capital, and we are pushing it further and saying, wait out, is human capital actually a public good? Because work and all kinds of occupations, and I would subscribe to that actually, I think, have a role in society. Not only the more, you know, traditional prestigious one from airline pilot or doctor, but actually, as you said, the trades, electrician, you know, the cleaners, you know, even the person that, I don't know, provides entertainment, you know, like clowns, for instance, like anything that, in a way, you can make the argument that, well, yes, it might sure that it's one person and depends on the personal skill, but one, this skill comes from a series of things and might come as well from education, which, as we discussed, it can be seen as a public good. And the work this person is going to do is a work that is going to benefit society on an aggregate level.
I think you have to go beyond this idea of, well, people are profit or benefit maximization units, and they're just trying to get the maximum benefit that they can, to recognize, as Joe was talking about previously, these unintended consequences, right? So that's, I think, one of the things that we're talking about is, yes, Fleming makes some very good arguments and gets a lot of these things that might not be as visible about the darker factors of human capital theory out in the open. And then Joe likes to talk about, and I agree, his view is very insightful, this idea about what are the unintended consequences? And what do you, when you're going to make these changes, what are the things you have to think about? And that one of the big challenges, I think, is that this fragmentation of work and the point Tom made about seeing employees as external, you know, it's hard to have collective ways to look at that and talk about, well, what does that mean? And do we, you know, do you have to say we want everybody to have a guaranteed minimum income? Or do you say, well, maybe we don't want to have races to the bottom in Uber employment, which such that, you know, they start working at one level and then a bunch of people sign on. The next thing you know, people working for a minimum wage. I mean, those are the kinds of things I think. Maybe it's not a direct payment, but it's a way of saying, and some countries do that. For example, in Spain, many of the cities in Spain don't allow Uber drivers. You know, some Madrid does because I've used one there, but some of the smaller cities don't. And, you know, personally, as a commuter, I just want to get to the next place. I'm not necessarily looking at the lowest possible cost because I recognize it has consequences if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, to piggyback on a term that Pedro used, hidden cost, the challenge. Big challenge is, how do we make all of these hidden costs?
Right.
How do we expose them, I guess is the best way to put it. Because that's what is, I think, is continuing to allow some of these trends to move forward, is that as long as the hidden costs remain hidden, that allows us to continue on the current path. And as the societal cost, the cost to the fabric, the cost of all of these things that Mumby brought out in the article in terms of stress and well, Fleming talked about it too. Stress, dissatisfaction, all of these have a cost. How do we actually make them, how do we make them manifest, make them tangible, so that when we look at alternatives that would help to restore some sort of societal fabric that is currently being torn asunder, according to these works we're studying, how do we rebuild that societal fabric in a way that allows us to measure the delta between what the hidden costs are, what are now hidden costs, and get those reduced.
When I first started reading it after having read Fleming, I thought, so what? This is just about resistance. Why? You know, why? How does this really relate? That often happens when I get something from Joe, and then I have to spend some time thinking about it. And I think that resistance is one of the ways to make those things more visible, right? I mean, if you go to the very basic level and you look at Taylorism. And when a tailor initially came to the workshops, people resisted by doing what Taylor calls soldiering, which is like just slowing down, which drove Taylor nuts. And I don't know if he ever, Taylor never really, I don't want to say understood, but, you know, he just felt that people were being, it was bad behavior. And yet, you know, we've read other articles where we find out that, you know, Banana Time and the Roy article that hey, that's a way of workers getting attention to their problems. I mean, they may not be saying, hey, it may not be exactly a cry for help, but they're annoyed and angry when they're doing stuff like that.
And in many ways, we've actually gone down this path before, because that's where labor law got to where it is because for specific or even more general cases, business case was made and a law was created to regulate that aspect of the business. And what we've got is a situation where primarily because of technology, we can far outstrip the ability for labor law. But at the same time, it also makes the problem much more visible. And so my hope would be that we'd be able to do some of that quantification, turn it into a labor law that makes sense, has thought about some of the unintended consequences, if you will, and then leads to actually an improvement in the situation for those who have been at the unfair end of the transaction.
Well, and for
economists, from what I understand, have the term for that, externalities, which exactly this kind of known.
Yes.
Right.
It's a convenient term which enables you to shift the focus to something else.
Yeah, when I hear economists talk about externalities, I always think of is somebody else's problem. And I think one of the things that we've been talking about is these are not somebody else's problem. They are our problem. And I wanted to add what Joe was talking about, labor law. And for people who are listeners who are interested in knowing a little bit more about that, the Berganis et al. Article is really good. It's from Tilburg University, because they go into quite a bit of labor law and how it's evolved and its differences in different countries. And that was real eye-opening. That was also, I thought, very helpful to read.
Well, we discussed many, the themes we discussed today, in a way, are linked to a number of other episodes and discussions we had before. I mean, Taylor has been featured here very heavily, and I think there's an interesting discussion on whether this is a hyper-Taylorism. It is a Taylorism that has, in a way, subverted the original goals, because we have the bad side of the control, but don't have any kind of, the kind of resources that Taylor envisioned, or even protection that the worker should have. There is a lot of links as well with episode 34 from that we discussed the text by Tristan Bamford. There as well, we talked about how change can lead to unintended consequences and how new ways of organizing the work can undo cohesion, sense of community, how much lack of autonomy or the individualization of work can lead to negative consequences. So there is also a parallel there, I think. We discussed about the gig economy before on the episode 18, in which we're specifically looking at more or less Uber and similar services and how much of the devices and control mechanisms that they create reflect what would be typical of a Tayloristic industry organization. And I don't know if you guys agree, but there is also, I think, I see at least some links with the last episode, episode 35,
yes,
because there I think Arlie Hochschild was looking at something about the exploitation of work, of a part of your own body as being, tapped upon by the corporation. And here's more the exploitation of the employment relation. So also on the topic of connections, I think this essay is hitting on the same note of an event that we are very excited that we are organizing together with SAMS and Texas University, which is going to be about the sharing economy. It's happening on the 15th of December in Texas University. And in the event, what we are trying to look at is that how the management of work currently in the sharing economy is linked to previous arrangements and how much of the current discussions have connections to previous classic ideas and concepts, basically what we have been trying in all these years in the podcast to do, to show how much current phenomena can be enlightened by looking at the classics. And I think the essay by Fleming does this very well, because in a way it provides a long history of the sharing economy. It shows how such an idea from neoclassical economics, has been serving indirectly as the justification. He talks about the alibi for development of, this more exploitative, sometimes, work arrangements. So I think that's why we are particularly interested in this essay, because it shows how much what we're seeing here now can actually be better understood by having a broader understanding, in time and space of different ideas and how they get reconfigured So we would be trying to do a similar, I would say, work in this event.
Right. So that's www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. And the event is called Old Wine, New Bottles. And that's our quick summary of what Pedro just talked about, this idea that we think the classics are very applicable to these kinds of trends that we are looking at in the gig economy, and that potentially a new understanding or an enlightened understanding of how the classics pertain can reconfigure our understanding. So that's why it's called Old Wine, New Bottles. And that's all for episode 36. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. Please join us next time as we discuss a real classic, Xenophon's Economicus, with our special guest, Dr. Peter Adamson, here on Talking About Organizations.